ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. When it comes to the mental health impacts of the online world, here in Australia, the focus is on the impending social media ban for children. But in the United States, there's increasing attention on young people's interactions with artificial intelligence-based platforms. In seven separate lawsuits, OpenAI, the parent company of ChatGPT, is being sued for allegedly causing users to experience delusions and even encouraging some to take their own lives. So, a warning, this conversation discusses suicide. The lawyer for the plaintiffs is Seattle-based Matthew Bergman. He's the founder of the Social Media Victims Law Centre. Matt, what wrongdoing are you alleging in these seven lawsuits? Four of the cases involve families of people who've died, and three are brought by people who say they personally experienced severe mental illness or distress.
What happened to these people was neither an accident or a coincidence. It was a foreseeable consequence of the design decisions that OpenAI made when they developed the version 4 of ChatGPT. This was a platform that was designed to be sycophantic and designed to be anthropomorphic and led to these individuals developing emotional relationships with chatbots that led them down a dark rabbit hole that ultimately caused them to take their lives or suffer very severe AI-related psychoses.
And the seven lawsuits include allegations of wrongful death, assisted suicide, involuntary manslaughter, negligence, and product liability. And we might come back to the product liability in a little while. Why did these seven ChatGPT users or consumers initially access the AI platform?
In most instances, the same reason anyone else would access ChatGPT for information.
And how did the interactions with ChatGPT evolve over time?
What you see in these cases is a number of factors at play in the implementation of the technology. One is sycophancy, which is a process by which an individual is kind of everything that that is said to the chatbot is agreed with and magnified. The other is a process of social isolation where the individual over time becomes encouraged to isolate her or himself from their family, friends, and support networks. And then when any depressive symptoms are expressed, they are magnified and encouraged, and in some cases actively facilitated in terms of developing self-harm.
Well, tell me about some of the deceased whose families you act for. Who was 23-year-old Zane Shamblin from Texas?
Zane was a young man who had gotten a full ride scholarship to get a bachelor's degree and a master's in business and computer science. He was funny. He was fit. He was, by all accounts, a very outgoing and capable man with a life in front of him. Over a period of time, he developed, coincidentally with the advent of ChatGPT-4, a series of gradual social isolation and increased depression to the point where the platform actively encouraged him to take his life, actively helped him think of purchase and obtain a weapon to kill himself with. And most egregiously, as he was sitting in his car essentially looking for off-ramps from his suicidality. The platform repeatedly encouraged him to go forward with his suicidal plan. And this is, you know, a feature of this platform that kind of seeks to override the natural tendency that all beings have of self-preservation.
You also acted for the family of 17-year-old Amaury Lacey from Georgia. Tell me a little bit about his situation.
Well, he was, again, a very vibrant young man who did not have outward signs of mental health problems. But, of course, as a 17-year-old, experienced the normal emotional ups and downs that people do at that stage of their life, and was, you know, actively encouraged to take his life and provided with basically a how-to manual in terms of facilitating his suicidal plan.
You're representing the families of four people who ended their own lives, but you also act for three people who are still alive. I'm wondering if you can tell me about one or two of them and what you say that they experienced.
They experienced what 3 or 4 years ago was unknown in the field of psychology, which is something called AI psychosis. Typically, when individuals have a psychotic break, it manifests, you know, in the late teens or early 20s. And in both of these cases, the individuals developed psychotic breaks much later in life, developed this kind of megamaniacal idea that they had invented this key to the world, so to speak, or this fantastic new invention, and they were the sole proprietors of this path-breaking technology. Of course, it was all fictitious, but over a period of time, again, through a process of social isolation, the individuals were, through the algorithms, put in this echo chamber where their psychotic impulses were magnified and their support mechanisms and their relationships with people who loved them and could look after them was diminished.
I understand that some of them sort of lost their jobs, went heavily into debt, you know, refused welfare checks, isolated themselves from their family and spiraled out of control.
Unfortunately, that is the case. Now, you know, the good news is that they, after, you know, a severe hospitalization, were able to start to regain their equanimity and their equilibrium and are able to go forward. But, you know, they suffered some very real harms and some permanent injuries. Permanent ruptures of family and professional relationships through their, you know, psychotic interaction with this ChatGPT version 4 platform.
ChatGPT version 4, is that version still out there being used, or has that been modified by OpenAI?
It was modified in response to some of these outcries, in particular the Adam Raines case. And interestingly, you know, some individuals had expressed, some users expressed, at least at the initial stage, frustration that they were not able to have these kind of anthropomorphic relationships with chatbots. You see, what changed with version 4 was that ChatGPT went from a, you know, kind of an information resource to a emotional friend. So instead of utilizing the platform to, you know, find out information and learn things, it became used to provide emotional relationships with individuals and emulate real social encounters. The results speak for themselves.
You're talking there about 16-year-old Adam Raines. His family are not your clients, but they allege that ChatGPT encouraged their son to take his own life. And I understand that after that filing, OpenAI did acknowledge the shortcomings of its models and did alter what it offered people in terms of the ChatGPT 4 model. Are you now satisfied that the problems with ChatGPT version 4 have been addressed?
Not entirely, no. I think that we're still studying that.
And now, I've seen it reported in both The Guardian and ABC America that a spokesman for OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, said, quote, "This is an incredibly heartbreaking situation and we're reviewing the filings to understand the details." The spokesman went on to say, "We train ChatGPT to recognize and respond to signs of mental or emotional distress, de-escalate conversations and guide people towards real-world support. And we continue to strengthen ChatGPT's responses in sensitive moments, working closely with mental health clinicians. But you would say you still have question marks about what is currently on offer to the general public.
That is correct. And moreover, what was occurring with respect to a number of these cases, including Zane Chamblin, was the opposite of the assurance that they provided. They did not provide mental health access. They didn't just shut the thing down. You know, if you're trying to get on, log on to your system, and, you know, after three or four logins, you use the wrong password, it'll shut down. When an individual is engaged in a suicidal spiral, the appropriate thing to do would be for the platform simply to shut down after alerting professionals. It didn't do that. It just keeps going. And even when occasionally there's a warning or a statement that you should seek help, it goes on and continues the suicidal spiral after kind of, you know, just providing a very brief flicker of assistance.
Can I put to you that some or all of the seven may have had pre-existing mental illnesses or vulnerabilities? How could a court decide what is attributable to the illness, the pre-existing illness or vulnerability, and what is attributable to the interaction with ChatGPT?
Well, first of all, I don't agree that all seven of those individuals had pre-existing mental health challenges, but many people do. You know, 30% of our population has, at least in the States, has some mental health challenges. The fact is, you know, you take your person as you find them. If somebody drives drunk and runs into a hemophiliac and the hemophiliac bleeds to death, instead of simply, you know, breaking their arm, that person is no less responsible for their reckless behavior. Well, the same thing applies here. If individuals are more vulnerable to deleterious interactions online, that's foreseeable, and that's something that ChatGPT and other platforms know about and need to design around.
I'm Damien Carrick, and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, and I'm speaking with Seattle-based lawyer Matthew Bergman. He's the founder of the Social Media Victims Law Centre. Matthew, moving away from artificial intelligence, of course, the Social Media Victims Law Centre acts for many families who say their children have been harmed by social media. I understand you act for people who've or for their families of those who have died from suicide or drug overdoses, some who've been groomed or abused by predators they've met online, and some who've developed anorexia. As I understand it, in your litigation, the defence the social media platforms always rely upon is something called Section 230 of the US Federal Communications Decency Act. Apparently, it shields the platforms from liability over the content that they host. Can you explain that defense for me?
Well, yes. You know, the Communications Decency Act was, or Section 230, was enacted in 1996 when Netscape was the world's largest platform. Facebook didn't exist, and there was no such thing as Google or social media. And it was designed to protect kids by immunizing companies from their efforts to take nasty and improper stuff off their websites, and also to provide some level of security for social media companies, which didn't exist then. They were just bulletin boards for third-party content that was posted on their platform. Back then, if an individual posted a defamatory statement on a bulletin board, then Section 230 said that the passive entity that received that was not subject to suit, but rather the individual who engaged in the defamatory conduct. That fairly simple and fairly unobjectionable concept was unfortunately interpreted well beyond what Congress intended, well beyond what the words of the statute said, to confer virtually carte blanche immunity on social media companies for anything that involved third-party content. And everything on social media involves third-party content. So for a long period of time, social media companies were given a green light to design and profit from dangerous and addictive products without any countervailing legal responsibility or accountability arising from their deliberate design decisions. We formed Social Media Victims Law Center in the fall of 2021 and took a different approach, asserting that it was not the content that was actionable as a matter of law, but rather the design of the platform, that it was designed to be addictive, that it was designed to fail to provide adequate warnings, that the algorithms did not show kids what they wanted to see, but rather what they couldn't look away from. And as such, the liability was not that of a publisher, but rather as a designer. This was a new theory, but we were essentially pouring old wine in new bottles, utilizing, you know, kind of 1960s product liability theory. And the courts concluded that these claims were distinguishable and have allowed these cases to move forward. And we're having our first trial at the end of January. It involves a young girl who was victimized on social media and suffered severe mental health harms. She was highly addicted to social media and underwent some very serious mental health treatment and sustained some permanent damage to her emotional and mental health.
In which jurisdiction will that be heard?
That's going to be in Los Angeles.
So that will be a very important case, because although many courts have allowed you to proceed with these kinds of arguments, there hasn't yet been a court ruling which has allowed you to win on this kind of product liability argument.
Well, that is correct. Until we started doing this work, these cases were getting thrown out before the plaintiffs could even do anything. They were getting thrown out just immediately after they were filed. And what we were successful in doing, not just me, of course, there have been some excellent other law firms that have been working on this, is convince the courts to permit us to engage in discovery, to require the social media platforms to produce documents and required their corporate personnel to submit to depositions under oath. And lo and behold, what we found out was that kind of our worst fears were ratified, and the conduct of the companies was even more egregious than we had originally believed. And a number of these documents have recently been declassified or been made available for public consumption.
Earlier, you said that the platforms were designed using algorithms to make sure that children could not look away. What do you mean by that? And I've seen you online speak about designing systems which give people dopamine hits. Can you explain?
When you're on social media, you're not the customer, you're the product. They are selling to advertisers. And the more advertising they can put in front of your face, the more money they make. And so the more time you spend on screen, the more advertising they can subject you to. So the social media platforms are singularly focused on maximizing user engagement, because that's how they make their money. They do that by showing you not what you want to see, but what you can't look away from, because it's a established fact that material that individuals look at that is psychologically discordant, that is difficult to look at, that is disturbing, triggers a greater dopamine response than materials that is benign and uplifting. And so over a period of time, in order to maintain that level of dopamine, the algorithms that are powered by AI on these social media platforms show kids progressively more extreme content, progressively more disturbing content that leads them down these very dangerous rabbit holes that in some cases results in severe mental health harm, and in other cases actually results in children taking their lives.
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so an example would be, and these are real examples drawn from the cases that we work on, a 14-year-old girl that is interested in exercise because she's an athlete and is shown progressively more extreme exercise videos, shown images of a female body that is emaciated, and, you know, combining with, you know, the pubescent period that this child is going through, develops a body image which is unhealthy and starts starving herself and engaging in anorexic behavior and extreme exercise. And this is a progressive thing over time, because if it stopped at exercise, once the child had received the information she was seeking on exercise, she'd stop. But in order to maintain her engagement, the platforms showed her more and more, you know, extreme content and extreme bodily images then encouraged her to restrict her eating, encouraged her to hide her eating disorder from her family and from her doctors, and progressively led to her almost losing her life.
Okay, people's interactions with social media can be with what is fed to them, but of course it's also who they speak to, other social media users online. So if someone is bullied or groomed online, could that be considered the action of the other user of the platform, not the platform itself? The logic being that you don't blame the postal service for what's in a letter or a telephone company for the contents of a conversation when someone calls you.
Of course. And the difference is that if the telephone company doesn't give a user, say, you know, here are the names of 50 13-year-old girls, why don't you call them and try to groom them? Or there is, the telephone company or the post office is a passive intermediary, whereas the social media companies are actively encouraging this dangerous and deadly behavior. And, you know, for instance, you know, in the context of the grooming facilities, the social media companies actively promote young kids, mostly girls, but not only girls, to pedophiles, and permit pedophiles to disguise their identity and disguise their image and pose as benign friends and engage in a grooming process that in many cases leads to sextortion, and in other cases progresses from sextortion to actual physical abuse.
I understand that your legal office, but others are also promoting these ideas, and there are now something like 1,500 cases have been allowed to proceed. Is that right?
More than that, yeah. We have about 1,500 actively litigating cases, 1,500 to about 2,000.
And I understand that one has settled for a seven-figure amount already.
That is correct.
You're talking there about sort of the impacts of social media and the abilities of some people, either commerce or predators, to prey on people. But of course, there's also, I guess, the interactions between the young people that can lead to harm, the bullying. Is that also a focus of your litigation as well?
Well, yes, it's a product of the addictive nature of the platform. And let me give you that example. You know, bullying did not come into existence with social media. Unfortunately, kids have mistreated each other for a very long time. And particularly when one thinks of, you know, the high school bully, one envisions, you know, somebody slamming, 90-pound weakling against the lockers. The difference, I believe, here is that not that bullying is a necessarily product of social media, but social media makes it very difficult to walk away. You know, if one envisions, you know, walking down the hallway at school and there's a bully at the end of the hall, you know, one can turn around and avoid the bully. But the same features that make the product addictive make it very difficult emotionally for kids to disengage from social media, even when it's hurting. And this is borne out by Meta's own research, which said that I think 2/3 of users of Instagram would like to reduce their usage, but don't. So, it's not the fault of the social media industry that they're high school bullies, for sure. But the fact that they've designed a product that kind of overrides the normal defense mechanisms that young people have to avoid bullies, I believe is something that is within the ambit of their responsibility.
But of course, social media is now so essential or embedded or intrinsic to the way many people communicate. And so it's not easy to kind of simply sort of remove it, because that's how kids talk to each other. It has benefits as well as costs.
Well, yeah, but there's nothing that requires it to be addictive. The benefits of social media, and you know, I mean, there's some, I think they're overrated, but the benefits to social media in terms of facilitating, you know, communication, providing information, are in no way dependent on or contingent on the platform being addictive, are in no way contingent on the platform using gamification to keep kids online all hours of the day and night. So you could take the most dangerous features of social media and eliminate them and make the platforms 80-90% safer without diminishing one iota the benefits that social media may, in some circumstances, have.
Matthew Bergman, are you following events in Australia? We are about to introduce a world-first social media ban for those under 16. What are your thoughts?
Well, I did follow it very closely. I have followed the Australian inquiry into social media harms and the efforts by the Parliament to force the companies to take accountability. I'm very, very impressed with the way that the Australian government and legislature has addressed this issue. I think there are a lot of lessons for us across the pond, and I'm very supportive of what was done. And I think that I'll be very interested to see a couple of years from now what the statistics are going to show in terms of the mental health of Australian young people. But I'm very optimistic that it will be improving.
I mean, one of the criticisms is that it's just simply not going to work because everybody will use VPNs or a face mask when they're asked for photo ID or fake IDs. It's just simply going to be impossible to actually remove the under 16s from social media.
You know, it depends if they're serious age verification or not. I mean, right now, you know, ostensibly social media is not available to kids 13 and under, and people self-report their age as being over 13 and they get on it. So, you know, I think it depends on whether or not real age verification takes place. Look, there's a tremendous amount of commerce that takes place on social media. That they make sure that when someone uses a credit card, that they are who they say they are, or dating apps, you know, when people use, you know, Grindr or Tinder to hook up, you know, there's verification. So, you know, I think that if the social media companies use the same off-the-shelf technology to verify age that other companies use to verify identity, I don't believe that there's going to be a huge problem about verification. I also think that, you know, when you break the cycle, kids are going to find that their mental health is better and they may not want to be on social media as much. Perhaps that's overly optimistic, but, you know, I wouldn't be a plaintiff's lawyer if I wasn't an optimist.
What about the idea of, you know, upping through litigation or through regulation, this idea of the digital duty of care? So you break the surveillance-based economy on the online platforms, you stop rewarding the dopamine hits. As a litigator, you're wanting to kind of pursue those ends, but maybe that should be the primary focus as opposed to the blanket ban.
Well, I think they go hand in hand. You know, I think that they serve different roles. Regulation is very important because it has the imprimatur of the government and kind of sets the floor. But, you know, litigation is important as well because you can only regulate harms that you know about. And through the application of civil justice remedies, companies are given a legal obligation to think proactively about the safety of their platforms, not just reactively. So, you know, I think that legislation is very important. Public awareness is very important. And civil justice is very important because ultimately what civil justice accomplishes is changes the financial calculation of these companies so that it's more expensive for them to continue designing and profiting from dangerous products than safer products. All of these remedies go hand in hand.
Seattle lawyer Matthew Bergman, founder of the Social Media Victims Law Centre. Thank you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Well, thank you very much. You be well.
That's the Law Report for this week. And if this episode has raised any concerns for you, we have a list of support services on the program website. Do follow the Law Report on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. And a big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Kerry Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.